Are you tired of working with generic IT providers that rely on you to be the expert? Arc IT goes beyond just fixing your tech headaches. They specialize in proactive IT management, BIM support, and data security for your architecture firm. The team at Arc IT gets your tech so you can focus on doing your best work. Whether you're a small firm of 10 or a growing practice with 50 or more employees, unleash the full potential of your creative vision with Arc IT. Visit getarcit.com and schedule your free IT assessment today. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our generous sponsors, BetterHelp and Arcat.com. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Mike Michalowicz, welcome back to Entree Architect Podcast.
Mark, it's so fun to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I love having you on. This is always fun. You always bring powerful, relevant content to our community. These are your people. And so I'm really excited to have you back.
Yeah, these are my people and I am theirs. Like, we're all entrepreneurs here. And I just love your community. Love the small business community. I love the impact that small businesses have.
Yeah, I agree. You and I have done things with Entree Architect, not only on the podcast, but you've been on Context and Clarity and you've helped us with expert training sessions. And so you've been part of us for a long time. You have a new book called All In. It's about unstoppable teams. But for anybody who doesn't know who Mike is, by his 35th birthday, he founded and sold two multi-million dollar companies. He's the creator of Profit First, which is a system or a book, whichever you choose, right? It's a book and then it's a system and it's used all over the world. Hundreds of thousands of companies using it. I'm sure many of you are using it. We talk about it in the community all the time. He has a lifelong mission of eradicating entrepreneurial poverty. I'm sure that's a term that you're very familiar with. He's the author of 8 amazing books, including Profit First, all focusing on how to help entrepreneurs like us succeed in business. He's been here before on the podcast. He's been here at episode 147. We talked about Profit First, which is a financial management system for small businesses and entrepreneurs. Episode 241, we talked about systems in the book Clockwork. So if you're struggling with your systems, go buy Clockwork. Episode 340, Fix This Next. If you're struggling with your business and you don't really know what's wrong, buy Fix This Next. Read it. That's one of my favorites of Mike's books.
Thank you.
It's another book that comes up often and is recommended here. It'll help you understand where to start, right? You have all these problems. It'll sort of analyze your business and it'll say, okay, start here, fix this.
Yeah.
And then episode 412, Get Different, marketing, talking all about marketing and branding, the things that help attract your customers to you. His latest book is All In, and he talks about how to build unstoppable teams. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about teams. Mike, before we jump into that, and I'm really excited about this conversation about teams, but I want to remind everybody who you are. I want you to share your origin story. We talked about it in a couple of other episodes, but you have a great origin story. So where did this all start? Where did you discover your passion for what you do? And maybe even who or what inspired you to get started?
Yeah. So I never planned on being an author. That's what I am or who I am now. That's my career. And specifically for small businesses, prior to that, I was a small business owner and I still am today. But I thought I knew everything about entrepreneurship. There was a period of time after I built and sold a couple of companies. I'm like, my gosh, this is now I got figured out. I'm pretty much a genius. And my ego inflated like massively. Then I lost everything. So I started a third business as an angel investor. I lovingly call myself, you know, it's the angel of death because I had no idea what I was doing. I was messing up these businesses and I thought, well, if I'm here, we're going to be successful. The moment that began the transformation for me, at least the realization that I knew nothing about entrepreneurship and I had to relearn it, or at least knew very little about entrepreneurship, I lost everything. My accountant calls me and says, Mike, you need to call bankruptcy. Now, just 2 years prior to this, I was a self-made millionaire and now it was all gone. And I lost my house 30 days later, lost my possessions. I came home to my family, my wife and my three children, sobbing after I had to finally acknowledge that I had failed. I'm a failure. And I told them we're going to lose everything. My daughter, I looked at her and said, in addition to losing the house, in addition to losing our stuff, you can't go to horseback riding lessons. She ran out of the room as quickly as she could to grab her piggy bank, ran back to me, and she said, Daddy, since you can't provide for a family, I'll start providing for us. And it was her life savings of nickels and quarters to buy a horse one day.
Yeah.
And that became this wake-up call of, that's the darkest, lowest moment in my life. But I'll tell you, that didn't trigger me to say, like, next morning, I'm an author now. I started a process of journaling. So I went through depression for 2 years. Early on, my solution was just, you know, drink a lot and maybe that'll get you past the day.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine said, start journaling, which is the guy's term for start a diary. And what he said was, your goal with your journal is not to write like, oh, today was successful, or I got out of bed. He said, just write down your emotion. It's a poor man's version of therapy. Just get it all out. But what was interesting is I started writing down, I thought entrepreneurship was XYZ. I thought if I did this, you'd get the results. Is that really true? And it started this quest for finding what I believe to be the foundational truths of entrepreneurship that we don't know. I started challenging, you know, profit first is profit, we've been told, is the bottom line. And then I came across it, said, I was told profit's the bottom line, but I never made profit. My gosh, what if profit's not the bottom line? What if it's the first thing we need to address before even expenses?
Yeah.
And I started doing it for all the stuff. I have about 25 books I want to write, so I'm not even halfway there yet.
That's awesome. That's good for us.
They're all from this journal. So that's the source.
Yeah, fantastic. And I'm glad you did, right? I'm sad that you had to go through that, right? But that's also something that's a lesson right there, right? That usually the things that you become most successful about, the most successful with, are sprung from and inspired by your deepest, darkest days.
Well, I'll just tell you the discovery I had in the last few years, but the more I think about it, I'm like, this is it. Whatever we are compelled to provide, teach, give, as architects, as authors, ever we're compelled to teach is actually what we need to learn. That was like the biggest discovery, that I have such a thirst to understand these different topics of entrepreneurship because I need to know it for myself. And when I figure this out, I have the opportunity, the privilege to share the word with others. Every entrepreneur I've met with, the best of the best realize what they're doing is really satisfying something internally that they need. And once they have that realization, unstoppable, they become the authority.
Yeah. And you could feel that in your books, in your writing.
Thank you.
You can feel that you're writing to yourself almost, right? That this is something that you've...
Starts off with Dear Mike.
Exactly. But that's a good thing, is that you've been through this, right? That you can feel that and you've written about it, right? That you've been to the darkest days and you've come up and you've become successful. And in every book, you can see that this is a multi-year exploration into this topic, right? You've immersed yourself in, like with Get Different, you've immersed yourself into the world of marketing and branding and all the things that come with it, right? The most complicated systems. And then you take it and you filter it all the way down to the things that this is what you need to know. This is what you need to do. Go do this.
I think complexity kills so many businesses. This belief that I now call it entrepreneurial entropy, that we just keep expanding and expanding and adding, saying, oh, this will fix the business if I just do a little bit more. And I realize growth scaling happens through subtraction. In fact, I can't remember which book I put it in, but I said, this is the most conflated terms is growth and scaling. I'll go to a conference and someone's like, yeah, I'm trying to scale my business or I am scaling my business. I'll say, well, how are you doing it? And I'll say, well, I'm working longer hours. I'm trying to bring on more people. We're expanding our offering. I'm like, oh, that's not scaling. The real simple definition is growth is a result of putting in more effort. So to grow, you do more. Scaling is a subtraction of componentry, is leverage. So to grow, do more. To scale, do less. And that's what I try to do with my books, with my own businesses that I own today, is what can we remove down to the core essentials that'll push it forward? Because then when you focus on that core essential and your energy's all there, now it's concentrated energy. It can have a real multiplicative impact.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk about All In. It's about teams.
Yeah.
Because this is a topic that our community is struggling with right now. We are small firm architects. Small firm architects are entrepreneurial architects. That's what Entre Architect comes from. That's the inspiration of the name of our community. And when we experienced the pandemic, we all freaked out. We all thought this was going to be the worst time of our businesses. We all thought that everything was going to slow down and that the recession was going to come and then there was going to be this massive depression. And it didn't, for architects, it didn't happen. It was a pandemic boom that we've experienced and we're still feeling it, which is great, right? It's great that we got a lot of work. We helped a lot of people in the work that we did and continue to do, but we had a huge problem with attracting the right people, right? To build our teams. Because once you bring in all that work, now you have to get that work done in order to satisfy your customers so you can keep bringing in more great work. And we're still struggling with that. It's hard to find the right people and it's hard to retain those people. How do you keep them motivated to do the best work so you can satisfy your customers? So All In is all about that. So where do we start? How do we do this? Where do we start?
Great question. So the three elements that we can talk about is recruiting, retaining, and raising the bar. I'll start off with a personal story because there's an origin for the work I do. There's an origin story behind this book specifically. And I think it's perhaps you'll discover here one of the greatest motivators. How do you get the people that you do have elevating and performing at a higher level and even encouraging others to work with your firm? Like that's the dream setup. So here's the quick story. I used to own a computer forensics business. That was my second company, computer crime investigation. One particular day, I was in my office and I was crunching numbers. I spent a full day on this and I came out, I was like, my gosh, we can achieve $10 million in revenue. And up to that point, I never had a business of that size. So that was a big deal for me. I had 30 employees. We were a brick and mortar business back in the day. It was just kind of cheesy. I had a whiteboard in this center communal area where we had our huddles and stuff. And I put 10 million in nice bubble letters. And I took one of those oversized post-it notes and kind of stuck it over so you couldn't see it. I called all the employees together. I'll never forget, I queued up some pump-up music. It was Eye of the Tiger, you know, the Rocky theme song. And I'm like, I run the numbers. I spent this like good minute preamble trying to get the team pumped up. And I said, I have the biggest revelation. I'm setting a new mission and goal for us. And it's something that we can accomplish this year if we simply do a few right moves. And with great flair, I rip off this post-it note to reel $10 million. And that's right when, you know, the core theme of Eye of the Tiger is kicking in. It was a perfectly orchestrated performance. And no one gave a crap. Like there was no like, oh, this is amazing. It was like, okay, Mike, that was awkward. And then people kind of sulked or slumped back to their office. And I'm like, this is the greatest epiphany. We have a corporate mission. My assistant at the time, her name was Patty. Patty came up to me and she said, Mike, if we achieve $10 million in revenue, you get the bigger house, you get the new car. But why should we care? What about our vision? And that was the day, Mark, I realized, oh my gosh, the corporate vision, the small business vision, isn't the vision for the small business. It's the owner of the business. That's our dream. What about theirs? Now, I don't care if you have one employee or one contractor or vendors or a mix of people. That is your team. Everyone has their own vision. Everyone's trying to accomplish something for themselves. That's when I started to realize, we actually literally did it yesterday here in our office. I sit down with all my team members. This is my author office. I have some other businesses too, but this office, we have eight people. And we sit down and we say, what are your dreams and what's your vision? One person wants to buy a new home, for example. Actually, she's looking to move to a new home because she's in a flood zone and it's a big challenge for her, but this is the vision that her and her husband have. Another person wants to learn to speak Spanish and be fluent at it. Another person is fighting cancer or has overcome cancer, but wants to sustain that health. Once I started to realize, oh, we all have our dreams. The job of a leader, our job, Mark, is to identify the dreams and visions of our colleagues and then to empower them to pursue that dream through their job. And I'm not saying, hey, I'm going to go out and buy your house for you. We don't gift a dream. Actually, that can defeat the accomplishment anyway. So it's not a good move. But my job is to keep that dream at the forefront of that person. If I can block and tackle, make introductions, I will. But just to support them in the accomplishment of it. And by keeping their individual visions and dreams at the forefront of their lives, they keep the dream and vision of the company, that's my dream, at the forefront of me.
Yeah.
And because I'm defending for them, reciprocity, they're defending for me. That revelation has transformed, and we've been doing this for now for years here. It's transformed the engagement of my employees. And I would argue they perform at the highest level because they realize they're not satisfying what Mike wants, we're satisfying what we all want.
Yeah, I love that. Empowering their dream.
Yeah.
And your role and your business, that's the role of your business, is to empower your team's dreams individually.
The individualization is locked arm. That instead of like the leader kind of breaking through the ice and people behind them as they blaze the path, it's us arm in arm, and it's this march forward. Outside my office, just, there's a wall here, but on the other side of the wall, and you can't see it, but it's about maybe 10 feet high. On the other side is this, was a barren tree. It was made out of wallpaper that was cut in a way to look like a tree with no leaves. What we do at the end of every month, we sit down and say, who here has checked off a dream of yours? Someone says, I want to spend more time with my family, my mother, my aging mother. Someone wanted to clean out their attic. There's no dream too big or too small.
Yeah.
If you accomplish it, you add a leaf. Well, this tree has bloomed massively. I've never seen a tree with so many leaves on it. And it's a celebration of each individual. So there's a public acknowledgement. What's funny was yesterday, as we did this setting of our visions and dreams for this next year individually, I asked the team, I said, hey, why don't we take down all these leaves in a tree? It's overwhelmed. And they said, no, that's staying. We can't put any more leaves. It's now a blob of leaves. They said, oh, let's start planting flowers around the tree and let's have birds flying by. There are all these different dreams. So you can literally go on, you know, some website or something and buy leaves, and we write, cleaned out the shed, another year free of cancer, and they all get stamped up on the tree.
I love it. So you acknowledge their dreams, but then what do you do with that? I mean, I know that empowers them and it gets them excited about coming to work so they can achieve their dreams through your business. But how does that attract people to your business and get people to recruit the right team?
Yeah. So it gets people excited about, there's an awareness here. I'm not here to be of service to some other person. I'm here to be of service for the communal good, which includes myself. So our individual self is elevated. What happens then is they prioritize the dream of the business, and just naturally, it's a natural reciprocity. Mm-hmm. There's specific recruiting tactics, and I want to give you one that I think is the most mind-blowing. But just by doing that vision and dream setting, they talk about it. You know, when someone is at home or with friends at the local pub or something and say, how's your day at work or what's going on at work? I was like, oh, we set our dreams today. And the question is like, you did what? Yeah, you didn't report your 8 hours of work today and fill out a timesheet? No. So it brings us awareness and curiosity. And we've had people literally apply from outside of our country that said, hey, I've always wanted to work for your company. We had people now from Spain and other countries come and work for us just because they want to have the experience, which for a little itty bitty business is remarkable. But, and this one I'm so excited, Mark, to share. I hope you don't mind. I'm just going to ramble a little bit.
No, go for it.
This is the biggest aha with recruiting. So here's how it works. What I do when I do my research is I will look at a desired outcome. What do we want to achieve in a circumstance? What's the common action taken and what's the result of that action? Profit first is a great example. Almost all entrepreneurs I know, every architect I know, wants to be sustainably profitable. We want to have financial freedom. That's a great thing. We don't have to worry about bills. Okay, so we want financially free. What's the process we follow? The process is, have sales for your business, subtract expenses, what's left over is profit, that will bring financial freedom. But what's the actual data show? Less than 17% of businesses ever are profitable. Almost everyone is failing to be profitable. So I'm like, okay, so we have a desired outcome, but the mechanism is not working and the data proves it. We got to change that mechanism. That's why I said, take profit first. Well, in recruiting, what the process is, we want, the label we use is A players. I challenge that label, but we're going to use it for now. You know, a top performer, someone who's really committed to the business. What do? We go through a traditional interview process. We run an ad on, used to be Monster, now it's Indeed, whatever the flavor du jour is. What's the output? The output is less than 10% of people that are hired ever perform at a high level for a sustainable period. A rock star comes in and then splits for the next job, or someone comes in and they're quote unquote mediocre. What can we do to change that process of interviewing? Interviewing is abjectly a failure. It just stinks. There's another industry that never does interviews. They constantly recruit the best talent and the best match for their team. And it's a $500 billion organization or industry. What it is the sports industry. The sports industry does it through what they call camps and workshops. And what I'm trying to compel architects to do, small business owners to do, is start running camps and workshops. This is what I mean. A little bit of a story, but I think it's relevant. I played sports in high school, lacrosse. Not particularly a good player, not a bad player, played lacrosse. Got an opportunity to go to a camp at Hobart, which in the Northeast, you're from New Jersey, that's in New York State, but it was considered one of the elite college camps. And I went there with maybe 400 other high school athletes. And everyone was learning new skills. They're constantly teaching you. And during the process, they tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, to certain students, you're pretty good at this. Let's bring you to another field to hone in on that skill. And by the end of the 5 days, four kids were invited to play for Hobart Lacrosse. They cherry picked the best. But I think what's most interesting is everyone got better. I was not cherry picked. But I ended up playing lacrosse in college in part because of that camp. We can do this in our business. You may not know this, but Home Depot has a recruiting platform that you would never have guessed. It's a camp. What it is building birdhouses. Next time you see Home Depot say, hey, come to our Build a Birdhouse workshop, you go with a kid maybe and you build a birdhouse. They have an employee there specifically observing participation to see who is the most desirous of learning, who's the most participative, who's demonstrating the skills they want for an employee. And at the end, they tap you on the shoulder and say, you're amazing at this. Have you ever considered working at Home Depot? It's a recruiting platform. So here's the tip. As architects, run a workshop. You can do an online class. You can do it in person at your own facility if you have one. That'd be amazing. And say, ever consider being an architect if you want an entry-level person or already an architect, want to learn new skills? I'm running a workshop. I invite you, charge people to participate. My parents subsidized it, but my parents paid for the Hobart thing. They're like, Mike, you better get a lot out of this. This is a big cost. One indicator of interest is a fee, meaning you're showing commitment. So charge for it, reasonably, but charge for it. Secondly, as you teach, realize you're elevating everyone in this process and you observe who shows the most desire and thirst and then tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, you ever consider working in this industry? We'd love to consider you. In this process, you're also elevating everyone. So give them a certificate of accomplishment. They spent 4 hours or 4 days or an hour with you, whatever you designate. So they have another accolade they can use when they're seeking an opportunity. So they're called workshops. The summary of this is don't interview. That's just people espousing what they did in the past. Hopefully it indicates the future. Observe through a workshop.
That's such a good idea. And workshops and courses are familiar to us all, right? We're seeing a lot of that through online businesses and those kind of things. Also in real life, we're seeing that, but I've never thought about using it as a recruiting tool, right? To create a course or a workshop that's specific that will attract the type of people that you want to work with.
Yes.
And then invite them to this course or workshop and have them go through the process with you, you teaching them the thing that you want them to do really well.
Right.
And you'll start finding the ones that are really good at it. And I love that.
It's unbelievably effective. Just a couple of little tips here.
Yeah.
You can do prerequisites. So this isn't just for entry-level folks. Say you need someone with a lot of skill.
Right.
Say that those skills are your prerequisites and here's an advanced learning. The second thing is you can team up. We worked with an accounting firm, a bookkeeping firm that was struggling to get bookkeepers. They teamed up with a university that had a bookkeeping course. And they said, we're going to be the outside professional. Could you imagine as an architect, go to your local university that has an architectural program and say, you have a real professional from the real world that's actively doing this, who is going to teach elements of this class. And if you don't have the skills to teach, you can always hire or bring someone else in to teach it, but it's under your domain. Then what this bookkeeper did during this process, they were working with the professor and said, who's showing the most interest? The most desire, who's asking the most questions, who's the most participative? And they identify those people. And those people, they said, hey, do you want to do a little internship with us to expand on the skill? Saw them in their workforce and then offered them jobs. What I love about that one, they had 12 women, it happened to be, go through this one particular course. They cherry picked the two best fits. They're rock stars in the organization. But all the other 10 women, this is my favorite part of the story, got hired as bookkeepers at organizations. So you're elevating everyone in the process.
Yeah. And I could imagine that it would work for any level and 1099s, right? This doesn't have to be full-time, right? This could be
part-time.
If you were looking for somebody to do some drafting for you, do a workshop on effective drafting for your architecture firm.
Yeah.
Bring in 10 potential drafts people, go have them pay you $40, teach them effective drafting, and then find the two or three that work the best and offer them jobs.
Here's the coolest part, Mark, is that process, you know, the drafting course you're going to do, is this is no longer out an ad that runs on Indeed, we'll say. The challenge with job boards is someone needs to be actively looking for a job. Here's what you can do. You can go to your competition and saying, we're teaching a drafting course, or the 10 ways to elevate your drafting skills. Your competition may and will send their active employees to you to elevate their skill. So now you're getting a whole pool. Usually the top performing people you want, I shouldn't say usually, but in many cases, the top performing people you want are already gainfully employed. they just can't see beyond their current employment. Maybe there's opportunity elsewhere. So by doing this, your competition sends people. You have a much bigger pool. I believe we have to be ethically appropriate. And if they're a great candidate, you can say, listen, we have a job opportunity in this space for you. You're showing great skills here. We first suggest, if you like your current employer and you're gainfully employed, and ask them if they have the opportunity. If they're closing out this opportunity, we have it here and we'd love to talk with you about it. It's a great recruiting tool in that regard.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Architects, listen up. Is something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? Regardless if you have a clinical mental health issue like depression or anxiety, or if you're just a human who lives in this world and is going through a hard time, therapy can give you the tools to approach your life in a very different way. I know this community of small firm architects very well, and I see many of you struggling. That's why I reached out to this episode's sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp is a platform that makes finding a therapist easier because it's online, it's remote. And by filling out just a few questions, BetterHelp can match you with a professional therapist in as little as a few days. It's easy to sign up and get matched with a therapist. There's a link in the show notes. It's betterhelp.com/architect. Just use that link, betterhelp.com/architect. Clicking that link helps support this podcast, but it also gets you 10% off your first month of BetterHelp. So you can connect with a therapist and see if it helps you. If you need someone to talk to, consider online therapy with BetterHelp. Click the link in the show notes or visit betterhelp.com/architect. That's betterhelp.com/architect. Thank you to BetterHelp for supporting this podcast and for supporting our community of small firm architects. For over 30 years, RCAT has been providing AEC professionals with high quality and up-to-date building product information. Today, RCAT.com is much more than a product catalog, with BIM, CAD, and specifications created in collaboration with manufacturers. Beyond that, RCAT.com also offers lead data, continuing education resources, newsletters featuring the latest projects and products, and don't forget, detailed podcasts. RCAT.com is truly the one-stop shop for everything architecture. Try it out. Go to RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com. Now, I could also imagine that it's a great referral tool, right? That if you bring all these people in that are high-level quality potential employees, and maybe the two or three that you've selected and hope to have come work for you, you know, they're not available. They may know four or five other people who would fit that spot perfectly because they just went through this process. They know what you're doing and how you do it. And they can maybe match you with somebody else who potentially could be a perfect.
You touched on a magic word, potentially. When I was writing All In, I was looking at what identifies or what are the elements of a candidate we want to consider. What almost every employer considers is experiential ability. You know, what you've demonstrated in the past is an indicator of the future. And we all know from resumes and so forth, which is a history of someone's experience, it's not necessarily a good indicator. So some businesses have elevated to what I call innate ability. This is stuff that Enneagram and StrengthsFinder, these different tools out there, analyze the natural wiring, I guess, of someone. And that is a great leg up. But there's something that's the kind of 80% middle, which is the most important, which is least considered, which is potential ability. And potential ability is, what could a person do in your environment if they could express their full potential? How would they perform? And of course, we all want that. The question is, how do you find it? It's through these workshops. And also you can do what's called skills assessments. I called upon the University of Chicago. They have a medical department. It's a hospital. And they ran a wildly effective experiment back in the mid-90s. What they did was they were looking for administrative staff. And the recruiting director said, well, I'm really good at interviewing. I can just get a feel for someone. Recruiting director, though, was challenged by other people on the board and said, we don't think we're getting the best candidates this way. So they ran a test. The recruiting director interviewed, it was 52 people, and ranked them top to bottom, but did not disclose her rankings. They then took those same 52 people and put them through skills assessments. There was a six-station setup that emulated an administrative role in the hospital. One component was check-ins, but the person running the check-in desk didn't just do the super efficient check-in. she emulated having cerebral palsy. Her roommate actually has it or had it. And fine motor skills are very difficult. Taking a license out could be a minute's process. And they had people do this check-in in this circumstance. And some people were very gentle and say, please take all the time necessary. Other people said, I can assist you. If you want me to take your license, I can enter it. One candidate literally ripped the license out of her hand and says, give this to me. It's taking too long. Now, that candidate obviously was not suited for this role. But the irony is she was the number one interviewee. And it's very obvious. She asserted herself. She shows confidence. But when it came to the necessities for that role, she didn't have that inherent skill. They hired based upon the skills assessment. The candidates they hired, I think it was like 17 or 18 people, have, over the history of since then, been the top performing people in the organization, best retention, and so forth. What I think is the hero of the story that doesn't seem like is the hero is the recruiting director. Because the recruiting director said, I know the best way. I interview well, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm willing to be challenged. And I think that's the definition of extraordinary leaders in this environment, saying, I'm doing something, I believe it's right, but I'm willing to challenge my notion.
Much of what you're talking about makes me feel like, especially the pieces earlier with the dreams of your team and the tree and the leaves, a lot of that is culture building, right? You're building a culture within your firm that sort of attracts potential recruits, which then you go through this process.
Yep.
But also retainage, right? The second R that you were talking about, you said recruiting, retainage, and what was the third one?
Raise the bar.
Raise the bar. And so once you do attract this team, your dream team, right? You got all the people in the right seats. How do you keep them, right? How do you keep them happy? How do you keep them motivated? How do you keep them from being poached by the other firm that's going to potentially listening to this podcast is going to go poach your team? How do you keep them from leaving your firm?
So this was something that I had to redefine my understanding. I thought that culture was immutable, meaning I had a certain set of values that if I brought to the table, if I hire people around those values, that represents our organization and it's very clear and distinct. It's immutable. It was never changing. What I realized is that was wrong. And it's funny, I even espouse that in my books, like set the rules and keep the rules. What I found is there's something that defines culture that we need to consider first, and it's community. The more diverse a community is, the stronger it is because it brings about different perspectives. Now, the personal realization I had, and it only happened a few years ago, we had a retreat. We do a quarterly retreat, but annually it's a go-away retreat. And we went around and our team was sitting around the fire pit outside, and we started talking about the values of the organization. I said, you know, one of the key values, and I'm a little cheeky, it's no dicks allowed. And what I mean by this is life is too short to deal with dicks. I don't accept that in the business environment. And I don't permit myself to be that dude either. And my team looked at me and said, gosh, we get it, but that's so bro-y, Mike. Let's freshen that up. And we said, well, what's our collective value? Well, there was a popular show at the time called Ted Lasso, this eternal optimist that has turned around a team that was struggling just because he cared enough. And they said, that's what we need to be. We're really about being the Ted Lasso. Another person said, I really think it's about profound simplicity. Like, I like how we cut down to the essence of things. I started getting these perspectives of stuff that resonates with me and is absolutely part of me, but not something I saw as the collective whole. So what we need to do as leaders is regularly say, here's what we believed in the past. Here's what we stood by in the past. How have the values shifted now that there's a collective group to embrace everyone? Because if we come with a set of rules, values, and stick with it, a siloing effect happens and the business becomes very repetitive. And when we look at these old stodgy companies, all my analysis shows, oh, they commit to values that they were unchanging and we're not going to change anything. This is the way it's always been. The companies that are morphic and embrace who's in there and encourage diversity are the companies that stay the strongest the longest. And that's what we need to do for retention and raising the bar.
Yeah. Well, let's go right into raising the bar. How do you do that? How do you take that and raise the bar?
There's a sense of inclusivity. There's this feeling that I belong and this is about me. And we see in our personal lives too, when we want or desire something, we will pursue it. When we are required to do something, we will be resistant to it. So here's what causes raising the bar or not. There's a psychological phenomena when compliance is pushed upon us, like here's what you need to do, here's your job responsibilities, and if you fail to do it, you're in trouble. When we're forced to comply, we'll seek to defy. The best analogy I came up with, I think, is a rental car. When I rent a car, I'm told return with a full tank of gas or you're going to pay $10 a gallon or something crazy. You know, no scratches or dents, clean interior. So what do I do the second I leave the rental place? I'm doing donuts in the parking lot. I'm flooring it the second the light turns green. I'm jumping on those brakes because it ain't my car. Plus, who are they to tell me what to do? Now, conversely, when something is mine, like my car and my parking lot, the one I own, my behavior shifts radically. I don't do donuts in it. I'm much more gentle with it. I washed a car. I surely have never washed a rental before I return it. So if you want to raise the bar for your organization, it's about employing a sense of ownership. Have you ever had that feeling? I wish my employees would act like owners. Here's the technique. Deploy what's called psychological ownership. So there's two forms of ownership. There's what's called legal ownership. I own stock in Ford. I legally own some of Ford. When I drive by a Ford factory, I don't go like, oh my God, that building, part of that building's mine. No. Legal ownership is just the law. The sense of ownership is psychological ownership. That's when I feel I have possession. There's three ways to trigger that sense of possession. First is I have to have control over the object. So that car that I own, I park it where I want to park it. I drive it when I want to drive it. It's under my authority. So giving someone control and authority. Secondly is personalization. I can make it mine. I can program the radio stations the way I want. I can put a bumper sticker on the back or dice on the mirror. And third is intimate knowledge. I know all the creaks and crunches. I know what each button does. So the more I know about something, the more I have authority over it, and the more I can personalize it, the more I sense I own it. And when you hear an employee or contractor or someone on your team saying, this is mine or ours, they're indicating a sense of ownership. So they say, oh, that's part of the job. They don't sense ownership. That's part of my job. They sense ownership. So we need to do those elements. I'll give one example. I was working with a Texas smokehouse. They make barbecue. They had an employee who was struggling, you know, a C player, like the worst of the worst. And they turned this guy into the top performer. And all they did was deploy psychological ownership. His name was Joel, the employee. They said, hey, Joel, we want you to own. In the beginning, they started slow and they let it grow. They started off with a straw box on the bar at the place. And they said, you own the straw box. Whatever you see is best for it to keep it organized. So they agreed to a collective outcome, but keep it organized. However you want to go about it, it's yours. You've control and do whatever you want. And they wrote the words Joel's straw box on the straw box. And sure enough, for the next day and or two and continued on, the straw box was no longer exploded all over the place when someone took a straw over. It was always reorganized. They started to expand his sense of ownership. The bar mat became the cooler system. It did take about 2 years, but he now runs the entire restaurant and he's their top performing employee. He was giving a sense of ownership. Before, it was control and authority. Here's what you do and you better succeed. Ownership is here's what the outcome is that we agree to. You blaze the path to get there. It's a subtle shift, but the way we respond psychologically is massive, and that gets people to raise the bar to the highest levels.
How can architects do that? You have a team of architects, you have a leader, and then you have architects who are running projects, and then maybe you have a couple of people working for each one of those architects, sort of doing the drawings and doing the legwork. How do we do that at each level?
Totally. I would start with one person. You got to learn the psychology here. So don't say, here's a whole new method. So pick a person.
Right.
I would usually start at lower entry level type of roles because that's usually where people are forced into the most compliance. It's like, this is your job task.
Right.
So a draftsman, I don't know if that's low level, but say entry level draftsman. If they have a drafting room or draft table, say, hey, how do you want to design this and set it up? You're giving people control and authority and the ability to personalize, to lay it out their own way. One technique is sometimes labeling. So instead of calling the draft room, if it's Mark, call it Mark's room, because now it has a little more sense of personalization. And the second it becomes Mark's room as opposed to the draft room, now you have a sense of ownership. If you have a team, maybe three or four people are using that draft room, give the team a name. That brings about psychological ownership. So the blue team or the red team or whatever it is, and say, Mark, you're part of the red team. This is the red team room. And now you have a collective ownership. Give them intimate knowledge, which means training that's constant so they can expand their knowledge. One piece of pushback I get from people is if I train people, they're going to grow and leave. Yeah, that's a real possibility. But if you don't train them, they surely will stay. And now you have an untrained person staying. So remember, our goal is to support their vision. And if their vision is to expand and grow themselves, learn about their vision and be a supporter of it. One ultimate tip here too is we've had, not in the architectural space yet, but maybe you, listener, can be the first, is someone say, listen, one day they do want to have their own architectural firm. Learn from them if they want that. You know, 5 years from now or 10 years from now, we can make that a reality. we're going to grow you and develop you to have your own architectural firm. And on that 10th year, we're going to be your first investor and take 15% of that business and help you grow and get customers. So now their pathway is in congruence with your own expansion. So just a little micro tip. The last little tip I have is when you talk with a person, say, I really want you to own this. What would make you feel like you own this? And let them dictate the course a little bit too.
Yeah, I love that. And I have spoken to some firms that actually do that in terms of actively helping their employees grow and move out, right? And they start their own firm. They understand that this is a goal of theirs, a dream of theirs. They work with them through the years to help develop them to that point, which they benefit from constantly, right? Because now they have this sense of ownership. They want to do their best work. So now you're benefiting from that. And then they do move on. And then you have support from outside, right? Now you have a firm that can support you. You can send projects to, they can send projects back. They become allies to you. And if you do that over and over again, now you have a whole team of allies. And so it's very effective.
Yeah, it really is an amazing mechanism.
And I could also go back to the team analogy too. Every successful team, every one of those players feels an ownership of that team, that the work that they do affects the entire team for sure.
Absolutely. And that's probably the highest level of psychological ownership. There is the concept of mine, my possession. That's my dog, for example. And by the way, like no one owns a dog. It's a different living entity. It's its own individual thing. But when that dog is at the adoption center versus in your home, why do we feel we now own the dog? Because of psychological ownership. First of all, they're under my control and authority, right? They're in my space. They're not at the adoption center. I get to personalize it. I give him or her my name. Right? I give the name. I will use words like part of my family. You know, if the dog's male, this is my little boy or something like that. And intimate knowledge. I know a communication pattern happens. Like when the dog needs to go to the bathroom, he whines or will walk to a door. You start to understand intimately that entity, that living dog. And so we feel we own it, but you don't really own it. So that's the power of psychological ownership. It's an emotion. Some businesses say, I have to give someone equity in my business, an ESOP or something like that. The research indicates that while that triggers legal ownership, it's rarely effective because it's really executed properly. That people say, now you own part of the business, start performing better. But what happens is people say, I own the business, you owe me. It brings about entitlement. So we need to deploy psychological ownership with our employees.
Yeah. Even with legal ownership, the psychological ownership needs to be paired with it.
Particularly with it. Do be aware of fiefdoms. If someone gets all the intimate knowledge, if someone has total authority, they can start blocking out others. That's a dangerous risk. So you want to do the collective ownership. Instead of my dog, you want our dog. And how you do that is just have multiple people involved in a role. Build teams and have people belong to that blue team or red team also, not just owning their little piece by themselves.
Yeah. As usual, Mike, fantastic information here for our listeners to be able to recruit and retract and raise the bar for their own teams. I'm excited about reading All In. I'm encouraging everyone else to go buy the book. It's called All In. It's actually, the subtitle is How Great Leaders Build Unstoppable Teams. You can learn all about it at mikemakalowicz.com. And just a little inside tip, nobody knows this except me. mikemotorbike.com will get you the same place.
You nailed it.
Mike Motorbike.
Yeah, because no one can spell Mikalowicz.
Yeah, exactly. So that's for real. mikemotorbike.com will get you there. Mike Mikalowicz, the links will all be on the show notes. Mike, before we wrap things up, and this will probably come from what we talked about today, what's one thing that a small firm architect should do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I have a favorite tip. And you know, my belief is something small that has immediate impact, something that's easy, has immediate impact is the best. So I'm going to go back to the workshops. The best way to recruit is through workshops, but running a workshop may feel overwhelming. Here's the hack. See what exists right now. Where are people already going as students to learn about something? And then you attend as a student, even though you may know this stuff, to observe the others. So maybe there's a college course or an adult education class. Go to that class, sign up as a student, observe the other students, and now you're participating in a workshop and you can recruit folks.
Love it. Love it. Mike Mikalowicz, All In is the book. MikeMikalowicz.com. Remember, MikeMotorbike.com. The links will all be there on the show notes. Just go to the show notes and just click the links. Go buy the book. We'll have a link to buy the book right there. Mike, always awesome. I love hanging out with you. I love the energy that you bring to us. Your authenticity and your passion for what you do is so real. I appreciate you for the work that you're doing. The books that you write are impacting millions of people and thousands of architects. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing.
My heart is full. My ego has exploded. Brother, just thanks for having me, Mark. I appreciate it. And I got to get down to Charlotte. We got to get some coffee together or beer and coffee mixed together, which supposedly is delicious.
I'll try it. It's on me. If you show up in Charlotte, I'll take you to dinner.
Okay. I fly, you buy. That's the rule.
That sounds good. All right, Mike. Thank you. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend. That is the best way to help us grow. And that's how we have grown to serve thousands of architects just like you. Share a rating, write a review, but most important, share a link to this episode that you just listened to. Go send it off to a friend. I'd really appreciate it. Thank you to all our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources that we discussed today in today's episode, they're all found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network, the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community and beyond. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to this podcast. Entree Architect Podcast select episodes are available for continuing education credit. Go learn more at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up, architects. Join us today at Entree Architect Network, the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. That's you, with monthly business training, business resources, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects. Your peers are there. Hundreds of them are there already. We will provide you with the support and the encouragement that you need to succeed. Hey, and this is super exciting. This is new, coming in 2024. Entree Architect Coaches. Yes, finally, after all these years, business coaching for small firm architects. It's coming to Entree Architect Network in early 2024. Join us. Try Entree Architect Network for free for 30 days. It's free for 30 days. Visit network.entrearchitect.com to learn more. That's network.entrearchitect.com to learn more. Try it. Come join us. Try it for 30 days. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage. Love, learn, and share what you know.